Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist reading from the 29th of, I suppose it must be July, not June 2019. I'll just have a break before I launch into readings more of the problem with induction. May put you to sleep, but this is Hughes and Culture, Dinosaurs in All Their Glory. It's a book. The giant lizards have won a huge fan base as new technology transforms what we know about them. Our popular book's keeping up, Ask Graham Lawson. Dinosaurs rediscovered how scientific revolution is rewriting history. I'm often asked, this is a quote, what is the point of paleontology's, writes Michael Banton towards the end of his frustrating new book, The Dinosaurs Rediscovered. I often ask myself the same question while I was reading it. Britton is a renowned dinosaur paleontologist at the University of Bristol, UK, and the author of many good books on the subject. His aim is laudable and timely, to tell the story of how, over the past 40 years, the studies of dinosaurs transformed from an antiquated branch of natural history into a highly rigorous scientific discipline. He knows the story inside out, having been one of its protagonists, but insider knowledge isn't always the best vantage point. Much of the material in the book reads like a textbook on how to do dinosaur paleontology, an introduction into the arcane academic debates within the field. Hence my frustration. This is a good story to be told about how modern techniques such as electron microscopy, cladiscus, whatever that means, CT scanning, and biomechanics have revealed things we would never considered unknowable scarcely 50 years ago. The findings include how dinosaurs rose to dominance and how their family tree fits together, as well as how they behaved, grew so large, and even what colour they were. They are all fascinating discoveries, but concentrating on the process, all too often Britton buries them in interminable detail, and prolific use of technical diagrams doesn't help at all. But it isn't all a slog. Sometimes inside the knowledge is an asset, as in the chapter on how fossils are discovered, dug up and prepared. As a lifelong dinosaur fan who spent many fruitless hours scouring bridges, cliffs and gullies for bones and teeth, this was the revelation. The section on extinction of the dinosaurs is also fantastic, finally retrieving Britton's true colours as a scientist, communicator and storyteller. Dinosaur devotees and paleontology students will find much of the value of the book, but for the more easily digestible primer on new discoveries, I would first reach for Steve Bruce's The Rise and Fall of Dinosaurs, A New History of a Lost World, HarperCollins, or indeed the latest book from another veteran populariser of paleontology, Donald Plethero, a Californian State Polytechnic University. Where Benton focuses on method, Plethero goes for the thrill of the chase. The story of the dinosaur in 25 discoveries does exactly what it says on the tin. It's a grand tour through those iconic finds from the Megalosaurus, named in 1824, to the Chinese feathered dinosaurs in the 1990s, via other must-see attractions including Stegosaurus, Diplodocus, Tyrannosaurus and Triceratops. With his latest book, Plethero follows a tried and tested formula. He has already had hits with the story of life in 25 fossils and the story of Earth in 25 rocks, so why change the winning framework? And while there isn't a lot there that's new, there's a pleasure in reading familiar stories. The listicide format is also a useful vehicle for easily introducing ideas such as cladiscus that Benton makes such a heavy weather of. Yes, paleontology has a point to help us understand the origins, evolution and history of life. To that end, it is a shame that both books were published too soon to react to the news about the fossil deposits, preserving what could be the debris of the asteroid strike that very probably killed the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. The authors of that claim to have been criticised for overinterpreting the evidence, and I would have loved to have found out what Breton and Prothero made of it. Well, I haven't heard that, really. Okay, primer on protests. Now, this is again books. A rushed book about the Extinction Rebellion is strong on tactics, but sells science short, finds Adam Bourne. This is not a drill, an Extinction Rebellion example. For a fortnight in April, the UK forgot about Brexit, fixating instead on a pink boat in London's Oxford Circus, and the disruption caused by thousands of climate protesters. More than 1,100 people were arrested, stretching police resources and leading politicians to meet the Extinction Rebellion, the group behind the spectacular display of civil disobedience. Now we have the book of the protests, rushed forward from the initial September publication date. This is not a drill, it's aimed at the curious public and those who may be thinking about joining it. It's a manual to, quote, help you, inform you, empower you to act, end quote. And his forward features a veteran Indian environmentalist, Bandas Shiva, who compares the importance of the groups to that of Gandhi's non-cooperation movement in winning India's independence. But it's very much a handbook of two halves. The first focuses on the facts about climate change and its less sober assessment of the carbon emission science and action. A more collection of antidotes. Former Maldivian President Mohamed Nasheed expounds the need to include the working class in actions on emissions, while two farmers in India and a US firefighter also share their experiences. Another chapter compares global reliance on fossil fuels and drugs. This could have been a colourful whistle stop tour akin to the start of climate change facts. The BBC's excellent documentary about climate change affects a widely varied quality of writing. At times the book plays fast and loose with some. Media savviness is also key, says the spokesperson from the Opera Exclusive, and a WhatsApp group for reporters to giving access to embedded journalists during the protest. Other members discuss coping with jail and cooking vegan food for protests. Like Greenpeace, they are big on good visuals, such as a pink boat they bought on eBay. As we energy system is largely authors of these doomed systems on the world rightly in the future remains concerned with this form of art should have found the firm And this is a view on culture, which I'll finish off with. This is a game, it's about games. Darker by Design. Dystopia is a big business in the games world. A new generation of titles plays on our uneasiness about the tech we rely on, channeling the dark influence of TV series Black Mirror, says Jeff Aaron. So I'm a bit like, I should actually watch that. You know, like that. Nervousness about technology is a defining element of the modern world. We are surrounded by gadgets and we can't do without them, but we also can't help feeling something isn't quite right about them. TV series Black Mirror is famous for exploring this idea about how video games are getting in on the action. But now, video games. In E3, the annual video games trade show held in Los Angeles earlier this month, our tech neuros were on full display in the upcoming titles that developers are touting. One of the standouts for me is Watch Dogs Legion, set in dystopian prospects at London. The Watch Dogs series cast players as members of an anarchist hacking group, DSEM, a thinly fictionalised version of Anonymous, equipped with souped-up smartphones capable of accessing nearly any electronic device. The previous game, set in San Francisco, was an entertaining satire of Silicon Valley and a video game culture. But this new title looks set to take a darker tone. In trailers of the game, the skies of the future London are filled with killer surveillance drones. Extremists have taken over and the DSEC resistance is fighting back. Usually there is no main character in the game. Instead, you can recruit anyone to your cause, from a gruff cockney bruiser to an older woman with reduced mobility but expert in hacking skills. Further into the future is Cyberpunk 2077, a world of neon screens, cybernetic implants, and virtual Keanu Reeves. The actor stars as a character called Johnny Silverhand, a kind of augmented reality ghost who appears only to the player. Like Watch Dogs Legions, the game also features hacking, using a essentially weaponized USB cable into the shape of a nanowire tool that can access the enemy's bionic arms and turn them against them. And it doubles as a whip. I'm interested to see how the game handles the ability to acquire your own cybernetic implants. A humanity score that goes down with each implant suggests that the game is taking a stance against augmentation. A less far-fetched is Telling Lies, an unusual game created by indie developer Sam Barlow, who created video clips using real actors. The conceit is that you are examining a hard drive stolen by the US National Security Agency, which contains secret recordings of people's online conversation. You can search the database for clips one word at a time. Love, for example, brings up clips using that word. Barlow's previous game, Her Story, uses a familiar idea to tell a non-linear murder story using a database of police interview footage. They can randomly guess words to search, but to really understand what is happening, you must pay attention and look for the first key phrases that crop up in multiple clips. Piecing the story together was incredibly satisfying, and his new game looks like an even deeper version of the same idea. So I'm really looking forward to it. As the trailer of the game puts it, the goal is to, quote, explore a stolen database of private moments. Very creepy, very Black Mirror. Okay, see if there's something else to read on here. What's wrong with the North Pole? Okay. This is really interesting, I find. What's wrong with the North Pole? The pole is wandering, and faster than ever. To understand why, we must journey to the centre of the Earth, says Michael Brooks. Can you point to the North Pole? Most certainly not. Even if you're armed with a compass, you would easily get it wrong. If you're in California, your needle might be 18 degrees out. You need to take account of that, even when you're just hiking, can be a difference between going left and going straight on, says William Brown of the British Geological Survey. It isn't just that your compass can be thrown off by local quirks that make it feel, the North Pole itself isn't where it used, isn't what it used to be. In 1900, the pole was in Canada. A century later, it's near Greenland. In the past 18 years, it has raced eastward about 40 kilometres a year, and currently heading towards Siberia. The weird behaviour of the Earth's magnetic field doesn't end there. It also occasionally reverses polarity, where many times in our planet's history, when a compass and needle pointed to what we call south. Even so, even now, there are spots under the surface where the compass would point the wrong way. What's going on? The mystery has deep implications for technology and the future of our planet. To address it properly, we would need to make, like Jules Verne, a journey to the centre of the Earth, where the field has a source. That isn't exactly practical. Instead, inventive minds have sought out magnets frozen into the planets aeons long ago and built a giant spinning spheres of liquid sodium, all of which could help us better understand our planet, evade solar storms, and perhaps take the right route home. Although a few of us have been anywhere near the North Pole, it feels a few years later back to the Grand Canyon or Mount Everest. Children know it as the place where Santa Claus lives. But there is even more. But there is more than one pole on top of the world. See diagram page 37. There is the geographic North Pole, which is with the Earth's axis contacts the ground. There is the magnetic North Pole, where the planet's magnetic field points directly downwards. It is the spot where it is this spot that is on the move as the counterpart of the other. And it's counterpart at the end of the planet. The magnetic South Pole isn't in the middle of Antarctica, as you might expect, but off the coast in the area of Victoria's land. Oh. For centuries, how the magnetic field was generated was a mystery, exercising thinkers from René Descartes to Edmund Halley. Einstein himself once considered the origin of the field to be one of the greatest unsolved problems in physics. He toyed with the idea that it was somehow a result of a mismatch between the charges on two particles, the electron and the proton. But the idea that was one, how it was first proposed 100 years ago by the Irish physicist Joseph Labor. He suggested that the field was the result of a rolling electrical conductive liquid at the centre of the Earth called a geodynamo. We have every reason to think that L'Amour was right. We know from the bouncing sound waves through the planet that it has a metal core in two parts. The inner core, at 6,000 degrees, is a tad hotter than the surface of the sun, but remains solid because of the immense pressure. The outer core is molten iron. The volume is 7 times that of the moon. The difference in the temperature between the exterior and interior parts of the outer core means the liquid constantly flows around in a convection current. Hot liquid iron rises through the exterior surfaces of the outer core and then cools, becoming more dense, descending again. The metal is crammed full of electrons and this moving flow of electric charge generates a magnetic field. Very hard to believe. It's full of electrons but an equal amount of iron. So if I get a big chunk of iron and just heat it up, I think there could be something, a temperature difference that will give you a peltier effect, which I can see. The fluid submersion depends on the convection alone. The Earth's magnetic field might be a relative to shape. However, the planet's rotation pushes the fluid around in a different direction, with a force that depends on where the planet the fluid is. Then there's the variable viscosity of liquid metal due to the different densities at the different distances from the inner core. This all adds up to a complex pattern of turbulent flows of the outer core, creating a tangle of magnetic field lines. Hello.
How are you?
I'm okay.
That's good.
If you're in there.
Hello.
Given all that, it might seem surprising that the magnetic North Pole isn't wandering more wildly, but the flowing happens in slow motion. When we say the flow is turbulent, we mean on a timescale of 10,000 years, said Gary Gasman of the University of California, Santa Cruz. Okay, an amp is a coulomb per second. It's just so hard to believe. I just find this the hardest thing to believe. Wow. That's pretty amazing, seeing it flow. The wandering of the poles can be explained by the slow motion turbulence then. But what happens next is unclear. Does the North Pole continue to move? And how far might it go? Could be on the verge of flipping entirely. These are questions worth asking. After all, the Earth's magnetic field flicks away charged particles and the solar wind, which would otherwise rain down on us. No one expects it to do anything drastic quickly, but if it did, it would cost us dearly. One way to get a handle on the magnetic field's future is to look at the past. When magnetic rock formation, such as feldspar, gets hot, and then cools again, crystals would align themselves to the prevailing field of the time.
Certain crystals have magnetic inclusions within them. Excellent records of the magnetic field, says John Tyler of the University of Rochester, New York. Reading these crystals provides a record of what the magnetic field is doing back many millions of years. And this is quite a record. It shows the Earth's magnetic field has weakened and strengthened throughout history, occasionally even flipping entirely. We know there have been 183 reversals in the past 83 million years, so that's no time. The last about half a million years ago, or 780,000 years ago. Turner and his colleagues have just analysed 565 million year old magnetic rocks in Quebec, Canada, and found the magnetic field back then was about 10 times weaker than it is today. The lowest value ever measured at this time, the Earth went through. A 75,000 year period in which the field was spluttering and stuttering, rapidly changing direction, its strength coming and going. This doesn't just confirm the Earth's field has been shifting for eons, it also reveals more of the Earth. Looks like the field was on the verge of collapse, says Torrey. If that had happened, it's unlikely that complex life would ever have been. Without the magnetic field, atmosphere would have been blown away by the solar wind. Disaster, according to Dino's interpretation, the magnetic field is the formation of the Earth's solid core. This is just so hard to believe because
I don't think the core formed so. Yeah, it's hard to believe because complex. We have cellular life, multicellular life, half a million years ago. Then, that's whole core. Water elements such as salt and oxygen would have been ejected from the solid and the friction core, making the impact resistance and adding a new power. We believe that the new energy source getting out allowed 400,000 years ago. So I just
find this really hard to believe, all this. His studies also revealed a patch of Earth's surface stretching from Zimbabwe to Chile, where the magnetic field today is extremely weak. So weak, in fact, that satellites and orbits that pass over it need protection. Without a shield, a normal magnetic field, the electrons are in danger of being fried by the solar wind. Yeah, I find it's hard to... boundary, the field is actually reversed. A compass down there would point south. It's an astounding thing. That's believable. He and his team see these anomalies in all sorts of places going back to the time and have begun to observe how they moved. It's getting to the point where we can track some of these anomalies in the core flows and Tardulian. Thank you. They occasionally appear. Sometimes things grow hard. The whole fluid suddenly reverses polarity. The strains of the Earth's North Pole signal an imminent reversal. This is the dragon's two opposing poles. When they allow the models to run, they see variations in strength over time and location. They also see wandering poles and even get the occasional burst. It all matches with what we see in the real world. In April, a simulation even managed to reproduce the behaviour that mimics the geomagnetic field lines. Magnetic jerks that the North Pole has taken at intervals during the journey eastward. Impressive as this is, it doesn't do the real magnetic field justice. Our computer models are complicated, but not as complicated as reality down there, says Gartzelmeyer. One has the computing power to model the field realistically. The flow structure twisting and shearing. The existing field and generating more magnetic fields in the process. We have to use a very crude approximation for this. What I think is that they've got these two rollers in there. That their field is effectively got two rollers. I just have to look at it. Things are even more complicated if you want to predict the direction of the magnetic field at any given point on the surface. Models of the Earth's Giordano won't do that perfectly because its concentrated areas of magnetic rocks can impinge on the local magnetic field, creating declinations where the field lines veer away from north and south vertical. That is why compasses won't point directly to the north in parts of California and many other places. Perhaps we need a more realistic model, a physical rather than a digital one, as the physical models of Earth none is more impressive than half a ball of sodium under the care of Daniel Laptop of the University of Arizona. Lathrop. Handle with care. As any chemist teacher will tell you, sodium is a difficult metal to handle, even in small amounts. It will catch fire when wet. Some, well, I should just catch fire, why not? sometimes spontaneously igniting in moist air and usually kept safely embalmed in oil or school chemical cupboard. Oh, sorry. Lathrop isn't dealing with small amounts of the stuff. He's rotating a ball of sodium encased in stainless steel, 3 meters across. The whole thing runs about 20 tons. At its center, there is a solid metal core, 1 meter across. It can be rotated independently up to 15 times the V-ray. An array of 31 magnetometers distributed around the surface measure the generated field. Because the model core is so much smaller than the real thing, Mary and his team compensate with a better conducting metal and then iron and a faster rotation. The fears to rotate about 4 times per second and we cranked up to full speed.
Oh, sorry.
Lathrop and his team have shown that the turbulent flow of a liquid metal will amplify and sustain the magnetic field, demonstrating Lamour's geodynamo hypothesis really does fit the facts. As yet, though, they haven't managed to get a magnetic field to appear spontaneously, as presumably the Earth must have done instead. They applied a sea field, which is amplified by the sodium sloshing forward but not back. It's a promising but frustrating. We can't show the Earth's magnetic field arise from nothing more than the movement of the conducting fluid, and without being sure of the model's validity, neither can we be sure of the neither can we use the sphere to predict the field while undergo reversals. Yeah, I do remember that there's two rotating cylinders in there. It's just, because just simple rotation doesn't get you your materials going up and down to the core.
You don't have a heat permit mechanism if you just have a heat gradient going up.
We might learn from a new and improved project under construction by Dresden, Germany last year. Researchers Helmholtz, Zillmann, Donaldson Lab, HZDR, has calculated that making sodium rotate on two axes could make a field spontaneously. Their calculations also mimic the way the Earth processes a 23.5 degrees from the vertical. The practical implication of this idea is not faint-hearted. It involved a cylinder filled with 18 tons of liquid sodium. Wow. This will rotate 10 times per second on its long axis and once per second on a slightly different axis. Safety is a paramount concern. Quote, we have a building dedicated to experiments with liquid sodium, and now there is a second building within the building, says Andrei Gritsik of HZDR. Nobody will be in the building during the experimental runs. These spectacular investigations are worth the effort. A better understanding of the Earth's field could avert a much longer danger. Why? If we can understand how our magnetic field varies, we might do more to protect the outer, protect our planet's grids from solar storms that can smash their way. Okay, sorry for pausing here. I'm just falling asleep here, so I'll keep on going. In the extreme, we could lose the field altogether, as perhaps happened to Mars about 4 billion years ago. That would loosen Earth's grip on the atmosphere and eventually would make our home as uninhabitable as the Red Planet. It may be flaky, and its poles may wander, but let no one take our magnetic shield for granted. Thanks a lot. Sorry for falling asleep.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.